Good morning. May it please the Court, Michael Tanaka, appearing on behalf of Mr. Dinh.
Could I ask you, I don't want to get into your legal argument, but just as a point of information, one of the arguments that's made here goes to the calculation of the guidelines. Does it matter, as I read this, if the whole spam count is thrown out, he's still left with a 70-month sentence on all the other counts that he was sentenced on? And so isn't the argument about the guideline calculation moot? I just want to know if I'm right, and then you can go on to your argument.
Well, it's not moot for two reasons. You're right in that it doesn't appear to affect his sentence very much.
I'm only asking you about that. I realize it's not moot in terms of all the substance.
It has an effect on the guidelines in that he got two levels based on that count for mass marketing.
But his total sentence was 70 months.
It was beneath the guideline sentence.
But he got 46 months on counts 1 to 6, according to what I've written down. And he got 24 months on counts 7 to run consecutively. So that even if we agreed with you, he'd be left with the same 70-month sentence. Is that right or wrong?
That is undeterminable. We would send it back for a correction on the guideline range. The advisory guideline range would be lower. Obviously, it would still be higher than what he got. But under the law of this circuit, because the guideline range had been incorrectly calculated, it would be remanded.
So you're hoping that the judge would rethink the whole thing?
Correct. Convictions are not insignificant. That he has a conviction for something that
that your main argument is moot at all. It survives. I'm just asking whether we have to get involved in this. Particularly, the judge was careful here to sentence. He didn't give one sentence, as is common, for all counts. He broke up the sentence count by count, and you're not even appealing from those counts, and he's got a 70-month sentence on those counts. And you want us to go in and get involved in a fairly complex issue of whether the guidelines for count 4 were properly done?
No, I don't. That's peripheral. And I actually want to address the loss issue because that is obviously more meaningful to my client. Of that loss, over $1 million, $987,000 of it was attributed to computer time.
Is that for this count? Does the restitution depend on this count?
No, the restitution, I assume, is connected both to this count and the wire fraud counts. Now, the only documentation for that was one, a statement by an Earthlink employee that they suffered $1 million in loss, with absolutely no factual explanation for where that came from.
The problem is that the Earthlink representative testified at trial and was subject to cross-examination on the amount of impact to Earthlink. You have a round of sentencing, and I've read the PSR, I've read the transcript, and I can't find any meaningful challenge to the Earthlink testimony at trial or the submission, which was slightly more refined, in connection with the sentencing proceeding upon which the district court relied. I realize that the defendant said something like the math was fuzzy, and this is ridiculous. But if I were sitting in the shoes of the district judge in the face of it's fuzzy, I would have no clue what to do about it except to say the government's submission stands.
Well, it is the government's burden in the first instance to prove loss.
Indeed, and they did. I mean, they put on a bunch of numbers. And I'm not saying whether they were flawed or not flawed. I'm just saying the government made a submission, and there was no counter to it. There was neither a formal objection to it. There was not a proffer of another expert to counter it. There was nothing to say that any part of that calculation, apart from being fuzzy, was in error.
We have to go through this chronologically. She testified at trial that there was $1 million loss. Of course, that issue was not of consequence to the guilt.
I understand.
Then the PSR just merely adopts that figure without documenting it at all.
Correct.
Defense objects, saying that this is
fuzzy,
a fiction. There's not a proceeds of the crime.
It's crazy.
There's no connection between that figure.
Word. My point here, Mr. Shimonka, is that that's just a word.
But the court has an independent duty to verify.
As a judge, I sit there and I read this, whatever it is, 15-page calculation. I sat through the trial. I heard the Earthlink representative testify. I heard cross-examination. And I say to myself, there's no contest here. There's nothing to challenge this.
Well, Your Honor, don't you read this and say, okay, where does this number come from? This number comes from the cost that Earthlink spent to buy their computers.
Well, I know. That strikes me as being fairly silly. But there's nobody who said that. I mean, there's not a soul at the sentencing hearing who said that. There was no – the math was fuzzy, does not communicate that you had no causal connection established between Earthlink's use of its servers and the calculation of loss, which is what your pitch on appeal is. That's completely – there's no place in the record where those words are even vaguely used.
Well, there was a suggestion that Earthlink – I mean, there was a statement, Earthlink suffered no loss. Now, it's up to the government to prove that
it was a company, and it's got to pay its employees anyway. Now, that doesn't
– Well, and it's a company that has to buy its computers anyway. Mr. Gooden's conduct did not cause them to buy these computers. They bought these computers as a cost of doing business.
Mr. Tanaka, if arguendo, if we agree that the numbers that were submitted by Earthlink in this were absurd on their face, just absurd, it couldn't possibly be right, can you show us, refer us to any case or any statute that suggests that if the defense has not raised a contrary argument other than saying it was fuzzy math, that we have an independent obligation as a review, a court of review, to go through and make the calculation ourselves, and even a right to do that, and indicate that this should be reversed because the underlying math is absurd on its face?
Well, I submit that any case that says clear error. The standard is clear error.
Do we independently have that right? Does the clear error have to be shown by you, or is that something that we independently can do?
I submit that.
See, there's no case, is there?
There's no case. Well, there's plenty of cases where the Court of Appeals has reversed a finding either on loss or restitution based on clear error.
I understand that, but in those cases, don't they always involve situations where the defense, if that's which side you're talking about, has produced evidence that shows that it's just wrong, and we agree with them on error, on appeal. What Judge Reimer's asked you, and I'm asking you, is even if we find this to be absurd, which I do, it's absolutely absurd. And basically, you're saying you used all 66 servers for all those 200 and whatever days, and your client is charged with that. It's absurd. But I'm asking you, is there any case law that says that if you didn't raise that point and you didn't bring this to the attention of the trial court, that we have an independent right as a court of review to make that calculation and to apply that determination for the benefit of your client on review?
Well, at the very least, you have obligation to remand.
Why?
The issue has been raised. The issue of loss was clearly raised. Now, this specific attack on these particular numbers, do they appear on the record? No, they don't appear on the record. But
didn't your client,
clearly,
didn't your client himself at the sentencing say that the figures are highly exaggerated, grossly inflated? And, quote, the reported loss consists of 260 days of use of Earthlink's mail servers although during the trial it was less than 10 days of server usage brought into evidence. Doesn't that come awfully close?
Yeah, I believe so, Your Honor. He didn't hit it right on the head, but the concept is there. This is so absurd on its face that he really shouldn't have had to say very much, and it's so absurd on its face that this court cannot let it stand. This would be as if he committed this crime using, you know, FedEx instead of our email, and the district court had assessed him the cost of FedEx for buying their planes. It's exactly analogous, and just on its face, it is so fantastic that I don't believe this court needs any more evidence. The government just clearly did not carry their burden here, and the district court clearly erred in finding this amount of loss based on this conduct. There is no causal connection at all demonstrated in any of those documents that they provided that ties this loss or this figure to anything that Mr. Gooden did, at least the $986,000 attributed to Computer Time. I want to spend like 1 minute on the Cam Spann conviction because, again, this is a clear example of the government charging something. It's clearly a crime, but something that didn't fit. The language of the statute is extraordinarily clear. It's targeted to emails, spam emails, junk emails, and it was not targeted to fraud. The says promotion or advertisement of a commercial service. None of these emails could be fairly characterized as that. All the regulations show that, and for that reason, that conviction just can't stand. Obviously, it doesn't affect his time any, but it's still an improper conviction. I'll save the remaining time for rebuttal.
Okay. Mr. Levin.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Daniel Levin on behalf of the government.
You might want to start with an explanation of why the loss calculation or restitution amount can stand in the face of just obvious absurdity.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's absurd. I think the questions he's raising are pretty legitimate questions, but they weren't raised in the district court. So I don't have a record to stand here and answer them directly. What we do have, though, is we have trial testimony saying this loss was $1 million. And it's not just the $1 million loss. Ms. Wilgerson actually explained how they put together approximately 70 different IP addresses, how they linked up approximately 70 different accounts that were sending the phishing emails.
But his argument is that the loss wasn't material at the trial, so arguably there was no real need to go into deep attack on it. Is that true?
Well, the loss amount was charged in the mail fraud counts, and that's why the district court admitted it was relevant to those counts, and that's why it came in at all. There was a sidebar, and that's why she let it in. So there was a relevance to it, and there was certainly an opportunity to cross at that point.
What was its relevance even on the mail fraud count, other than that there was a monetary loss? Is that it?
It's because of monetary loss.
It could have been $5,000, and you would have satisfied.
No, you're correct. The amount of loss obviously isn't an element of the count. It did come in without an objection. But moreover, it was the basis on which the PSR found the loss. So clearly, by the point of sentencing, the trial testimony is now relevant. And again, there's no effort to impugn that or controvert that. Instead, the argument, and the thrust of the argument, isn't this is fuzzy math, or isn't that the server time should have been calculated differently. The thrust of the argument is defendant should only be responsible for the $6,000 in money he stole. That's really the thrust of defendant's argument sentencing. That's what everyone's focused on. That's what the district court is focused on.
It went beyond that. What I just read from the defendant's own lips went beyond that.
He complains about the loss consists of 268 days, and he says it was less than 10 days of server usage was brought into evidence. Yeah, well,
this is all concocted to make this look like a case that should have been brought on that particular count.
Your Honor, I just don't think that's accurate. I think what we have here is Earthlink is saying these emails are passing through our servers over this date range. And there's trial testimony with that, and then in the loss grids that are submitted. And the fact of the matter is it could be that these emails are, there's a danger of corrupting the servers, that there's a reason why they think that it really is damaging, endangering the servers in a certain way.
But they didn't say that. Look, why would you object to a remand to thresh this out? I mean, here you have three judges of the court who think that this calculation is absurd. You represent the sovereign. Why is it in your interest to just argue waiver? Why wouldn't you be concerned about a just result in this case? And wouldn't a just result be a remand?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, obviously we could go back and do the sentencing again, and the defendant could now raise the issue.
We're talking about the whole sentencing. We're talking about this particular issue.
The problem is we have a situation where the defendant just, you know, waits and now on appeal has sort of a new set of questions, but we don't typically.
He's got a constitutional right to the effective assistance of counsel, which judges are obligated to see that's accorded to him. And quite frankly, if a proper objection wasn't made, there's an argument to be made that counsel was ineffective. But why do we have to go through all of that when it seems to me the perfectly just remedy here, which you should not be opposing as a representative of the sovereign, is to remand so we get a correct figure here?
Well, I think all I can say, Your Honor, is the government opposed a remand just on the basis of this isn't how we do appellate procedure, that we don't just go back and redo things.
So you want him to bring a 2255 and allege ineffective assistance of counsel. There's no strategic reason that anybody could think of why counsel would not have objected to it. And ultimately, it would lead to the same result, it seems to me. So why don't you just do the right thing?
That may well be it. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves and say that, you know, I don't know what an ineffective assistance claim would look like in a 22-5 here.
It's quite clear.
I think it's the government's position that it shouldn't go back based on the fact that there was, the government put forward evidence that laid out the loss, and it's all clear. There's no hiding the ball of how Earthlink got to these numbers. It's laid out in these forms. This evidence is out there. The district court relied on it without any significant objection from defense counsel or defendant. For us to say, well, the district court ought to go redo it now because there's new claims, isn't really.
Let's go beyond. I agree with Judge Corman on this, but let's go to another issue that's raised in this matter, and that is the jury instructions. When you look at the statute and this, and read what commercial electronic mail message is, how that is defined, and then you look at the jury instruction, it is vastly overbroad compared to the statute. It really allows you to bring in what this defendant was alleged to have done where it would not otherwise have normally fit within the definition of the statute. Why is that not reversible error?
Well, I think Your Honor is referring to the related to
correct
clause.
Correct.
And I think, to begin with, that was a clause. The defendant agreed to these instructions. They were prepared by the government. They're jointly submitted by both parties. The government concedes that the related to language sweeps in relationship and transactional emails.
It goes well beyond the statute.
It goes well beyond what would be commercial electronic mail messages, because it picks up these relational emails, and it does that. The issue here is whether there's plain error, because these just aren't relationship and transactional emails. The statute.
I don't understand what you're saying. You're saying it's not relational emails. They're not just two kinds, commercial or relational.
Well, I think there's the statute. No, there's other kinds. There's non-commercial emails.
Yeah.
There are.
So what you did, I mean, I don't understand why you even asked for a related to.
Your Honor, I don't.
What's the reason?
I think the reason is to sort of avoid a confusion with the jury, to give them sort of an opportunity.
Okay,
because
from what? I mean what the statute. The statute says commercial email, and it defines it, and it accepts from it a relational or transactional kind of relationship, which isn't at issue here at all.
I think, Your Honor, I don't know why the parties agreed to this particular language as opposed to just saying that following the precise words of the statute. But I think that the only problem, leaving aside the relationship and transactional issue, which I think it just wasn't an issue here, the only potential problem is if it broadened the idea of whether the primary purpose was advertisement or promotion, whether if the jury could have found the primary purpose was related to a product or service.
But isn't it fair to say, counsel, that it is highly improbable that a jury could have, based on this statute, found the defendant guilty as that statute is drafted? It's easy to see how they could find the defendant guilty on the jury instruction as that was ultimately drafted. And maybe it gets back to Judge Corman's point. Maybe this was, again, ineffective assistance of counsel, because the reality is the statute and the jury instruction have little in common with one another, because you've created a whole different category here that this defendant was swept into that would not have been covered by the statute.
Well, I don't think that's true, Your Honor. Let me give the argument. And granted, this was not the argument that was made at trial, because this just wasn't at issue at trial at all.
But that's why the ineffective assistance of counsel issue is...
Well, it was a different defense. The defense was, someone else did it, my mom, my kids. But the argument is that these emails, they are promoting and advertising, primarily promoting and advertising the defendant's website, the defendant's website for gathering information. The point of these emails is...
There's only one email, right, that's the subject of this case.
The November 23rd. There were multiple emails.
And
it's the same.
What in that is even fits the definition of primary purpose?
The primary purpose is
the commercial advertisement.
Because the primary purpose of that email, Your Honor, is to get someone to click on that link. The whole reason for sending it, they do it through lies, through misrepresentations that you've got to...
If he put something like, I'm a handsome young guy, could you please click on and get in touch with me? He would want people to click onto his computer, but that wouldn't violate this particular statute.
Well, there's two issues, I think. Let me try to unpack, because there's whether his website is a product or service, and whether the email is advertising it, promoting it, trying to get someone to go to it. I think here it's clear with respect to whether...
You're saying it has a commercial purpose because he wants somebody to email him back.
He wants someone... His website, which is the form mail website for gathering information, that's a service, because what it's doing is it's gathering up... You go to this website, you type in billing information, credit card, and so forth. The website, the form mail company, processes that information, spits out an email that goes to the defendant. The defendant then takes that information and engages in commercial transactions using the fake credit card. Stolen credit cards.
This is sort of Rube Goldbergian kind of logic. I'm looking at you chose to rest. If you would have rested on an earlier email.
There's the May email.
But that's not what the count of conviction is based on.
No, I'm just talking about the November email.
Yes, what is it? We apologize for the inconvenience, but your information needs to be updated. And then in order to enjoy your American Online Experience account, you must enter member information within 24 hours, and it tells them how to do it. Then if you need further assistance, call our billing department. And I don't see how that satisfies the statutory definition that the electronic message, with the primary purpose of which is the commercial advertisement or promotion of a commercial product or service.
And indeed, the jury instruction didn't require the jury to find that the email contained an advertisement or promotion, like the statute does require.
Because of the related to...
what you added into it.
I think the answer to that, and then I'll come back to the email itself, I think the answer to that is because advertise and promote, they are broad terms. And I think we have in our head a certain... It's what's on TV or it's what's on the back of the bus. But advertise and promote, it's putting out there, it's furthering, it's informing people, it's notifying people about something. That's all an advertisement is. It doesn't have to say, buy my product, it's the best product out there.
But counsel, this is a criminal charge we're talking about here, not a civil matter. And in a criminal case, someone needs to be able to look at the statute and understand clearly what you cannot do. I'm speaking generally. in this case, the government has expanded the jury instruction to include related to items that are never contemplated in the statute and do not require the jury to find an advertisement. How can you square that? And admittedly, there was nothing raised, but this is a plain error issue at this point. So if we find that this impacts on the fairness of the system and the administration of justice, aren't we justified in reversing this matter based on the jury instruction alone?
Were you to find that it was error, and I understand you think it's broader. I think just addressing the plain error analysis, it has to have been relevant to this proceeding, and
the whole idea of plain error analysis is that the defendant didn't raise it at the trial, right?
But it had to have affected substantial rights in that,
right.
And I think it has to have been that there was some argument being made that this would have had a bearing on, and this just wasn't the defense. The defense didn't have anything to do with the nature of the emails, the nature of his scheme. The defense was someone else did this. So it just didn't have any bearing on what was actually going on at the trial. And I think, frankly, that's my guess of why it wasn't objected to, because it just didn't matter to this trial. So it doesn't really affect the defendant's substantial rights under the plain error analysis. It doesn't impact the fairness of the
case. So you're saying that if the statute criminalizes conduct A and the jury instruction charges crime B, that the fact that the person is convicted of crime B has nothing to do with fairness and administration of justice?
No, Your Honor, because I'm also arguing that the evidence would be sufficient to sustain a conviction under the Can-Spam Act, leaving aside the problem with the jury instruction. Mm-hmm. Because the evidence would be sufficient to sustain a conviction under say, an instruction that just tracked precisely the language of the statute, we don't have it's not an issue of the defendant was convicted of a crime that doesn't exist. So I think...
In a way it does. I mean, you've got a conviction on these other grounds, of course.
Right.
And that's not affected by this. This guy's going to jail, is in jail, for a lot of crimes. We're talking about a specific one. And the question here is, under our jurisprudence, can you make this jury charge on this statute and have it be a lawful jury instruction on which someone can be convicted? Because it really is crime A versus crime B, isn't it?
Your Honor, except to the extent we conceded that they could have convicted them based on that a transactional email would have come within this, an email from a legitimate, two parties in a legitimate relationship and so forth. Except for that part, which just doesn't apply at all to this email, I think the rest of the instruction leaves behind the advertisement, the promotion or advertisement of commercial product or service.
But the government expanded this instruction, it seems to me, because it was worried that it couldn't convict him under the language of the statute. Isn't that a fair reading?
Your Honor, I don't think that that's the case. There's no record on why the parties agreed to this.
You weren't trial counsel, I guess.
I wasn't trial counsel, so I don't... But I think the answer is that it was a new statute, and it was an attempt to give something that the jury could deal with. And
what do you need this for? You know, this is what happens when you have a kitchen sink approach. This was a classic fraud case. That's what this is about. You have him convicted of about eight other counts that clearly fit what he does. Now you're taking a statute that, to me, is not so clearly applicable to the facts of this case. You throw it into the case for no apparent reason, and you're forcing us to reach essentially what I regard to be is a very close question, if it's even close, as to whether or not there's sufficient evidence to prove that he's guilty of a crime. Why is it necessary to go through the U.S. Code and pick out every conceivable statute when you have clear statutes that govern exactly what happened here?
Your Honor, I think at the time this was a new statute. When Congress passed this statute, it said...
I know, but you had all these other statutes. This is a clear mail fraud. It's open and shut. And you have these other counts that you have. This is a stretch. Just because it's a new statute, you had to throw it into the indictment? You wouldn't even retry this case, I guarantee you, if we were to reverse on the jury instruction. You wouldn't even retry the case.
That may be true because the other captain...
It is true. You know it's true.
Okay, counsel. Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Tanaka, do you have anything to say? Sometimes the better part of wisdom is not to argue yourself out of...
Just one observation. And I'll sit down. But you asked me earlier whether this court could remedy what they saw as an absurd calculation of loss. And it occurs to me that that's what an appellate court is for. If you see a clear error, then...
Well, an appellate court's not a court of first instance. In the place in the first instance, it's very costly to the system to sit back, roll the dice, and if the dice don't come out in your favor, then come up with a clever argument on appeal and then say, oh, goodness, let's just send it back and start over again. I mean, the system isn't designed that way.
Well, let me suggest that the first place...
I suggested that the better part of the valor might be just simply...
Let me suggest that I should have not said anything.
There's an old Spanish phrase, en boca cerrada no entran moscas. You might want to consider that one.
If you could translate that for me, Your Honor.
Flies do not enter a closed mouth.
Awesome. All right, thank you, counsel, both of you. The matter just argued will be submitted. The court will take a brief recess before resuming the calendar.
All rise.